Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first installment of Swing Politics. This is Mitch Saunders with WMFO in Medford. And today we're going to be talking about what else other than the 2022 midterms that are right around the corner. So I guess let's sort of get right into it, you know, right before this very exciting election that is in only 12 days and is extremely important for what we would consider to be the fate of democracy. So I suppose let's start off by kind of giving a rundown of what's going on politically in the world, politically in the nation, I suppose, in terms of metrics that we're going to be looking at before this election to see how we can gauge which party is going to do better in just 12 days. So sort of what the data is showing us at large, at least what I look at personally, is first and foremost the generic ballot polling that we see from that's been going on since the Obama era. And it takes a look at essentially individuals, polling individuals, asking them, would you rather support a generic Democrat or a generic Republican on the congressional ballot? And in 2018, as we all know, that was more of a Democratic year. So the generic ballot showed that the Democrats were up around, you know, 7-8% on the ballot compared to that of this year, which is kind of showing a bit of a mixed bag. Right now, the generic ballot is showing somewhere on at least on two different sites. One of them is Real Clear Politics, and the other one is 538. Real Clear Politics is showing about a Republican plus two environment compared to 538, which is showing Republican plus 0.4, which is essentially even. And that's been a pretty good metric of where the national environment tends to be, at least historically. When we've looked at data from 2010, 2014, 2018, it's been about just after Labor Day, in which the generic ballot was representative of what the national popular vote was for the election results. And realistically, though, we've seen a little bit of a swing where the Democrats were leading on the generic ballot just not more than a few weeks ago. In fact, it might have even been last week. And, you know, I'll get into sort of explaining why that is, more or less, but realistically it is something to keep a watch on, and I know that the Democrats have had a good few generic ballot polls that have come out for them, so we're really going to be looking at that going forward as just one of the biggest determinants of how the midterms go. But tied into that super, super directly is inflation and gas prices. Gas prices especially are very correlated with Democratic generic ballot testing. There was a Washington Post article that just came out, I believe it was a few days ago, and it had a correlation of, out of the way that this correlation works, is it's -1, 0, 1. One is a positive correlation that's extremely strong, the strongest it can be, and -1 is that's an inverse relationship that is the strongest it can be. And it ended up measuring at a -0.91, comparing gas prices shifted 3 weeks to Democratic polling for the generic ballot, which is crazy close. And it basically says that gas prices will determine what is going on in this election. And as it's kind of been seen along with that metric, is as we look at the generic ballot and we see the at least recent fall a few weeks ago, fall in the Democratic leading in those numbers, you also saw a rise in gas prices. And right now, many more of the recent polls, at least over the last few days, have showed Democrats leading on the generic ballot as gas prices come down again. They're around, from what I understand right now, looking at the tool that I use, Gas Buddy, is that it is around 370, but that depends on the region. So in the Northeast, it's going to be higher, more like 4. In California, that's also going to be the case, although I've heard that gas prices are dropping so rapidly that it's not even being sort of recorded in real time. There's been a few reports that California gas prices, especially because refineries are back up and running, have dropped around 70% from, or 70 cents from what I understand on the gallon. So that would be very welcome news for Democrats. And a lot of what we sort of experience going into these elections is looking at momentum, which candidate is or which party has the momentum going into it. So if Democrats are polling, say, at 47% and Republicans are polling at 42%, but in the last few weeks, Democrats stay at, you know, 46, 47, and Republicans have made their way up to 45, that's indicative that the electorate on election day is going to be a lot more Republican than maybe the polls were, because the polls are a lagging indicator. So it's very possible that these gas prices could have a direct impact on these generic ballot polling, and once the polling catches up and displays more of a Democratic momentum where they're retaking the gain in the generic ballot, they could see more of a benefit from those dropping gas prices, obviously due to the high correlation. That being said, I'm skeptical of the theory that Democrats will defy the odds as a party that is currently in power. They hold, obviously, the House, the Senate, the presidency, and that never bodes well unless the administration is George Bush and 9/11 happened, or there was an impeachment that was conducted for Clinton in 1998. But it doesn't happen in the modern era. So if we were to sort of get back on track to what the data is showing us again. So we've spoken about generic ballot. We've spoken about how gas inflation numbers and the inflation numbers, although high, are very good for Biden in that they're at zero and inflation can't get much better than zero. And also inflation is a global problem, but it to the average American voter, that doesn't really matter. They see their prices rising, of course, at the gas station, but they see it rising in the grocery stores. And although that's not Biden's fault, it's under Biden's administration, and that there's really not much that he can do about that, and it's something that they kind of have to bear the brunt of and hope that it eases a little bit as we go into these next crunch days before the election. So I suppose another metric that could be important, at least it was in the Obama era, was the GDP numbers that are, I believe, going to come out later this week, and that's going to be a big deal for that's going to be a big deal for the Biden administration. I remember there was discussion, at least it was, I believe, on a Pod Save America podcast, actually, that some of the former Obama staffers had seen a really bad November, I think it was, or October GDP report, or from the last quarter. I think they measure it by quarters. And it was the quarter going into the 2012 election, and that the GDP numbers were not ideal. Ultimately, it didn't matter as Obama won. But the GDP is always something that you want to be measuring. You want to look for. You want to make sure that the economy is strong, because it's not only what the reality of the situation is, but it's also the spin that the media takes on it. And if the GDP numbers are weak and unemployment is up and the economy is not producing what it should with the Inflation Reduction Act and all the bills that Biden and his Democratic Congress have passed, type of thing, that's how it's going to be spun. By especially, I can see the headline in the New York Times. So I think that's an important thing to take into account. Also, fundraising numbers on the Democratic side and Republican side at large have been a little bit been pretty much matched. There was a Democratic surge after the Dobbs decision that struck down Roe v. Wade after 50 years of remaining precedent. The fundraising numbers were a boon for Democrats. Democrats took the lead in the generic ballot. Things were sort of looking better for them, and that abortion was now something that voters were electing politicians to vote on, or to hopefully vote on. That in Biden's case, he's said multiple times that if he keeps the House and gains two seats in the Senate, which I find to be highly unlikely, as does every single projectionist pundit, all that. If they do, then they will pass a law enshrining Roe v. Wade into law. But recently, as abortion wasn't, you know, just struck down, and there aren't as many implications in terms of everyday voters' lives, whereas they go to the grocery store every day and they're saying the economy's bad and I'm going to vote Republican because they're going to change that, even though realistically we know that they won't do anything to change that. So getting back to the point, as I go down this rabbit hole, the fundraising numbers have sort of seemed pretty much matched. And if you're looking nationally, Republicans and Democrats are pouring tens and hundreds of millions of dollars into various races. In the Senate and the House and the governorship. But there's really not one party that necessarily has a lead nationally. There are, and we'll get into it, the specific races that have various sort of disparities in the terms of their fundraising for certain candidates. But at large, it's showing a horse race. And that brings me to my final factor, which is the fact that midterms are always a repudiation of the incumbent party, and especially the incumbent sitting president. And that's been the case if we go back, I guess, in modern era after 2002, because 2002 was the last election midterm that we've had where the president's party actually gained seats. But again, it was an anomaly because of 9/11. If we look at 2006, the reaction to the Iraq war handed Democrats the Senate and the House. In 2010, the reaction to the Affordable Care Act and Obama being elected was Republicans sweeping, I believe, the largest number of House seats in the history of the United States Congress. I believe they won 63 seats, either 63 or 67. I always get the number mixed up. Those and they didn't quite take control of the Senate because of the almost Democratic supermajority at the time, but they won around six seats in 2014. Republicans finally did take control of the Senate, flipping about, I believe, seven or eight seats, maintaining their control over the House. And then if we go to 2018, Democrats retook the House as a response to President Trump's presidency as a whole, that people were not super happy with, even though at the time the economy was good, which might explain why Republicans were actually able to keep the Senate in 2018, flipping seats in Missouri, Indiana, Florida. So right now, Biden's approval rating is not ideal. Interestingly, and the way that I at least measure it, as a lot of people do, is the 538 measurements, and that we've been seeing Joe Biden recover from the sort of major inflation gas price high of July, you know, over the summer. I was actually in D.C., and in some of the places there was around $5.50 gas, which was pretty crazy and understandable why, you know, people would blame Biden for it. But realistically, it was the Democrats and Biden that supported a bill to prevent price gouging by gas and oil companies that was refused to be passed by the Republican majorities. So realistically, they're campaigning on something that they want to continue to happen so that they have their majorities. But that being said, as inflation and gas price inflation has eased and gas prices have eased relatively, Biden's approval rating has seemingly sort of maintained at around a 42% average. And it was around about a 53% disapproval, and recently it's gone up a little bit. But when you're comparing this to prior presidencies, Biden's at about the same approval rating as Trump was at this day in his presidency. He's a little bit below Obama's, but I think that can be attributed to the, you know, hyperpolarization of politics and the fact that Obama today is living at least one of the most popular political figures. I think he has like an approval rating of like 60% or something, which is astronomical for a politician that was only in power six years ago. So it's not as though Biden or the Democrats are going to be buoyed by Biden. In fact, many of them have taken to it so that they don't have Biden anywhere near their districts. They want them to keep the campaigns local, and that tends to often be the case when it's Democrats running in close Biden seats or seats that Trump sort of narrowly won, and the GOP, on the other hand, when the GOP is running in Biden seats, they sort of want national. They sort of want to keep the race local as well, to ensure that when a race gets nationalized, essentially, Democrats and Republicans will revert to their natural positions. And I'll be getting to a special case in a Rhode Island House district election that sort of puts this on display. But sort of the data showing us at large is kind of a mixed bag. It's kind of showing an even environment where people aren't really necessarily voting against Joe Biden particularly. We don't really know that's the case. They more so might be voting against sort of what they think Joe Biden is doing, like the gas price and the inflation. So I guess it is fair to say that they are voting effectively against Joe Biden if they are. The generic ballot's very close. Fundraising numbers are very close, and gas prices are coming down. So it, based on what this is saying nationally, is that it's anyone's game. And as I'll get into, the polling is showing a whole different set of information, with some saying Republicans will sweep, others saying that Democrats will, at least hold the Senate, if not be competitive and limit the number of Republican wins in the House. But again, I'm wary of this reality in that it is extremely unlikely that the Democrats hold the House. And in my opinion, I think it's unlikely that they hold the Senate. But that being said, I think it's important to look at these specific races that will determine, especially Senate control, come 2023. So, let's get into that. So the way that I'm going to go through this is I'm going to start with the Senate, because personally it is my favorite chamber, because it is the worst chamber, and if you control it, you have a lot of power. And Democrats know and will know harshly that as their Senate map continues to whittle down the Trump state Democrats that they have in office, they will see that the Senate is an extremely important chamber to hold. We've seen that Trump and McConnell were able to confirm 3 Supreme Court justices and pack the courts as well. So the Senate's where you want to have control. You'd rather have the Senate than the House, of course. So the Senate right now is divided 50-50, as we all know, and the key pivotal votes tend to be Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. But as we're looking at the Senate going into this election, there are really 4 major seats that will decide who controls the Senate, and that is Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, and I am completely blanking on the last one. Nevada, Georgia, Arizona, and Pennsylvania, of course. How could I forget? So I guess we'll start with the one that has the first letter in the alphabet. We'll start with Arizona. So Arizona has a Senate race between Mark Kelly, who is an astronaut and the husband of Arizona beloved Gabby Giffords, who was a former representative in the House during Obama's first term. She was there, and she was in a shooting in which she got shot in the head, part of her brain, and she's been she dealt with a great deal of recovery. And she's kind of, at least from the Democratic side, Arizona's, darling child. They do love her. She's very much supported by a lot of Republicans as well as Democrats, and she has started a big gun control advocacy organization called Giffords. And Mark Kelly is her husband, which definitely makes him more popular. Looking at when he got elected, he was elected in 2020 in a special election, and he ended up running against Martha McSally, who was the sitting senator at the time, who had actually lost to Kyrsten Sinema in 2018. So Mark Kelly is running for the full 6 years of this seat, the full term, as that was a special election that he won. And he is running against Blake Masters, who is, a businessman, hedge fund type of person, very much a part of the far right wing of the Republican Party. He was endorsed by Trump very early on. And this race is one that, surprisingly, Democrats aren't sweating as much, at least relative to some of the other ones that they need to keep the Senate. I think that Democrats are feeling increasingly confident in Arizona and holding Arizona. The polling numbers right now, if I were to pull them up, if I can find them, the polling numbers right now show Kelly leading by 3.6%, 47.5 to 43.8. Biden won this state in 2020 by 0.3%. This is an extremely competitive state, but it's also lurching left. I believe Clinton in 2016 only lost the state by about 3.5%. And this is definitely a purple state. It's purple at the presidential level. It's purple at this is nothing more than a toss-up race. But if I were to give, if I were to pick a winner, right now, I would say that Mark Kelly has this one, more likely to win. And I think that the pundits have also agreed with that. His fundraising numbers are 2-1, or 1.5-1 outspending, Masters on the airwaves. And he's also, he's a very good campaigner. He knows how to, you know, interact with people and you know, it always helps that he has that sort of name recognition as a national figure, as an astronaut. It's like it's a very cool thing. I mean, people remember Gary Hart was a presidential contender in 1984, and he was a senator from Iowa, and he was also an astronaut. I believe that he was on the Democratic side running for that nomination. So astronauts are kind of a little bit of a cool breed in American politics, and I think that he shines through in that respect. He's also been, you know, largely in favor of, you know, the Biden administration policies, but at the same time has made sure to kind of distance himself to some degree, as he knew that Biden didn't win the state by a lot, and he won it by more than Biden in the same year. He outran him, and that it doesn't benefit him to bring Biden in and nationalize the race when he easily sees himself as getting some Republican crossover support. And, you know, I'll preface this after saying every single race, the polling could easily be off. We could see, a Republican resurgence in the last few days, and Mark Kelly could easily lose to Blake Masters. This is a very competitive race. But Kelly has sort of done everything in his power to keep this, seat blue. And I think things are boding well for him. So, Democrats can kind of, check that one off the box for right now. And out of the four states, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Georgia, Democrats need to win three of those four to maintain control of the Senate at 50-50. So, let's see, where else can we go next? I guess we'll go to Nevada because it's right next door. Nevada has first-term Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, the first Latina ever elected to the U.S. Senate, running against Adam Laxalt. Cortez Masto won this seat in 2016. Obviously, she won a full six-year term. She won by around 2%, and she actually replaced a Harry Reid in the Senate. She has sort of a record that's kind of not super high profile. She's not someone that's known very well, kind of, in at least, you know, thinking about Twitter media or thinking about politicians that you see on mainstream media. She's not really on there that much, and she's sort of the case study in seeing if Democrats are going to lose ground with Hispanic and Latino voters as the 2022 midterms move forward. Democrats saw a lot of loss in their support, especially in places like South Texas and Florida and Nevada as well. And the fact that she is Latina and she does have that descriptive representation for that group is sort of a question of, will Latino voters stick with her because they support her policies, but also because having representation in positions of power is extremely important for minority groups. And she's running against Adam Laxalt, who is the former Attorney General of Nevada. I believe that he was elected in 2014. I'm not totally sure, but I also believe that his father was involved in Nevada politics. And that he also ran against the incumbent Democratic Governor, Steve Sisolak, in 2018. And he lost to the sitting governor at the time, and so he's sort of back for round two in some way, not exactly in the same way, but he is, it's sort of well regarded that Laxalt is the most formidable of the Republican candidates that have been put forward. McConnell and a lot of establishment Democrats are extremely aggravated at the sort of MAGA boosted Republicans that have won these primaries, that Trump has played a major role in sort of deciding. McConnell feels that this was sort of a slam dunk for his party to take back the Senate, But with these subpar candidates, it seems less and less likely. However, Laxalt is a sort of exception to that. He was endorsed both sort of with the Washington Republican establishment leadership as well as by Trump himself. And when you have sort of both of those coalescing together, that's going to make a candidate that is hard to beat in a Republican year in a state that has, relative to the popular vote, swung right. Nevada voted for, I believe, if I'm not wrong, it voted for Clinton and Biden at almost the same margin, meaning that it was a little bit to the right of the nation in 2016, and it's now two more points to the right of the nation in 2020. So this is where many believe that the Senate will be decided. The polling right now, I could pull that up, is showing a very competitive race as well, which is what we know, and that Laxalt was leading for a little bit, and now it's sort of turned into Cortez Masto that has taken a little bit of an ultimately insignificant lead, with her leading 46.5% to 46%. And there is a, at least in midterm years, there is a historic bias that's actually been against the Democrats running in statewide elections. In 2018, there was an election between for Senate between Jackie Rosen and a Republican. It was Dean Heller, who was the incumbent sitting Republican senator, and it was basically a dead heat. I think that the average showed that it was a tie. And that it was an utter toss-up, couldn't get more 50-50, and Jackie Rosen, the Democrat, ended up winning by 5%. And I believe in 2014, and as well as 2010, in 2010 especially, there was an election between Harry Reid, and this was 2010 was, of course, a big Republican year, between Harry Reid and another Republican candidate, and Reid was down, I believe, 3 points in the polls, something like that, and he ended up winning by around 5. So there is sort of a historic bias of polling against Democrats in Nevada. So it's very possible that this might have just been sort of the older Democratic Party with more white working class, non-college educated support and more Latino support, whereas when that's not the case, a lot of those sort of unexpected, you know, hidden Trump voter types might not align as much with the Democratic Party and might turn out more for the Trump-endorsed and Republican establishment-endorsed candidate. So it's also, of course, a very good thing to note that Nevada is not a very populous state, and essentially the way that we sort of measure how this election is going to go down is based on the major county that holds Las Vegas, and that's Clark County. And there is a very, very well-seasoned reporter and data analyzer, John Ralston, who picks apart the early voting data and knows almost exactly how the state will vote heading into Election Day. And I've been following him closely on Twitter, and it's kind of a mixed bag with even him not knowing what's going on. So as much as the national data is telling us very confusing things, it is the exact same way for the early voting data. It's also really early to analyze early voting data. We still have 12 more days, a lot of mail-in ballots that have yet to be received, and Nevada is now a universal mail-in ballot state. That was passed by the Democratic-controlled state legislature, signed in by the Democratic governor in 2020. And this race has received a lot of attention recently, and it's definitely going to be one of the pivotal ones. If I were to pick two, then I'll go to that one next. If I were to pick two races to watch, this one and Pennsylvania, which I will head to next, are going to be the two that personally, in my opinion, decide who controls the Senate. So now that I've mentioned it, I think I need to go there. Pennsylvania is a really, really interesting Senate race for these midterms. This is an open Senate seat that is currently held by Senator Pat Toomey. Toomey was elected in 2010, I believe 2010. He was reelected in 2016, sort of against the odds. He was running against a woman by the name of Katie McGinty, who was a big Emily's List figure. She was big on gun control, and she was sort of slated to be Pennsylvania's first ever female senator, and she ended up losing to Toomey by 1.3%. And Toomey ended up actually outrunning Trump in 2016, who only won the state by 0.7, and Toomey won it by 1.3%. So Toomey decided that, I guess he didn't like the Senate, didn't like working in Congress anymore, and decided to throw in the towel, which left an open Senate race, which by all means should have been a slam dunk for the Republicans. Unfortunately, they had a very contentious Republican primary between three figures. Kathy Barnett, who's an election denier, far-right figure. Dave McCormick, I don't quite remember what his position is, but he was more a part of the moderate Republican wing, someone that was not an election denier and very much like a Toomey. Toomey is someone who's in the Senate and is very fiscally conservative, but he voted to impeach Trump type of thing, and that's sort of the same mold that I think McCormick fit into. And then, of course, as everyone knows, he won the Republican primary. It's Dr. Oz. Don't quite know where he came from entirely, but he was endorsed by Trump early on. I guess it's the national TV figures that kind of stick together. And in doing so, it actually did not secure him the nomination, and that it was an extremely close election between him and Dave McCormick that was only separated by a few, by less than half a percentage point. I believe it was like 0.1 or 0.2%. Now the Republican nominee is Dr. Oz. And he is running against the lieutenant governor, the sitting lieutenant governor, John Fetterman. He's lieutenant governor to sitting governor, Tom Wolf. And it's been a very, very interesting election season, primary season. John Fetterman was running against Connor Lamb, who was a representative from the Pittsburgh area. Both Fetterman and Lamb were from the Pittsburgh area. Lamb represents a House seat that was extremely competitive, and he gave it up to run for this Senate race. And Fetterman ran the boards. He won with about 60%, winning every county in the primary, which was a good look for him compared to the Republicans, who had to claw this out to a recount. Early on, after receiving the nomination, Fetterman had a stroke, and this stroke has impaired his abilities in some ways. He's still campaigning very, very heavily throughout the state, but something that happened last night, as with the debate between Dr. Oz and Fetterman, showed a struggle to deal with some of the things that I think a senator would be expected of. He had trouble getting his words out properly, sounded similar to like Biden in the 2020 presidential debates. And this is a man who had just a few months ago had a stroke, and sort of he had been, the Fetterman campaign had refused to do a interview because of a lot of the various formats that had been proposed that didn't work for him. Fetterman has also released a letter from his doctor saying that he's perfectly capable to lead, to be a U.S. senator. He can do that. But this debate was not a good look for him. It showed him as sort of unable to retort, speaking not really very coherently. And it was him that sort of seemed a little bit, he just seemed out of his league compared to Dr. Oz, who's a TV personality. He was very comfortable up there. But the big thing about Dr. Oz is that his unfavorables in the state are very high. So initially, between the Fetterman and Dr. Oz polling, Fetterman was polling 10, 15 points ahead of Dr. Oz. Now, realistically, the election result on November 8th was never going to be Fetterman winning by 10 points in Pennsylvania, which Biden only won by 1.2%, and Trump only won it by 0.7. That was never the reality of the situation. But the reason why was because Democrats were very happy with Fetterman, and Oz was a part of this divided primary, and he also had really high unfavorables. He was the Fetterman media campaign did a great job of painting him as out of state. He was focused on he was from New Jersey. He had voted in New Jersey in 2020 for the presidential election. He did not. He wasn't. He was sort of a part of this patrician class that didn't quite understand the working people of Pennsylvania, and he did a very good job in highlighting Dr. Oz's unfavorables and drove them up, and that was why his campaign especially did so well over the summer. Recently, of course, the polling has tightened, as everyone expected it to, because Republicans are coming home to Oz. They're saying, okay, sure, Fetterman might have this sort of this appeal about him that makes him look like the common man, but I just know that he's, you know, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders in disguise, and I'd so much rather have a Republican, a generic, who doesn't matter what Republican, in the Senate rather than him. And that's become clear as the polling has really tightened. I think Fetterman now claims like a 2 or 3 point polling average lead compared to Oz, but realistically all of that can, in my opinion, be thrown out the window until we see more polling from after the debates, which did not help Fetterman. That being said, you have to take into account the fact that that debates are largely don't sway too many voters. It's the people that are engaged that are watching, or I'm sure there's a select group of swing voters that really do feel that they sort of don't know. But it's more about sort of the clips and the bites that you get from the debate, more so than the debate itself. So, and the advertisements that you run. And so Oz is running with advertisements that Fetterman is incapable to lead. He's not able to even make up a coherent sentence. Whereas Dr. Oz had a statement that abortion should be between a woman, her doctor, and a local politician, which doesn't quite add up. At least, you know, if you are a woman in the state, and abortion and Roe v. Wade polls very high. The Dobbs decision was very unpopular, especially in a very pro-choice state like Pennsylvania. So, in terms of the fundraising between the two of them, it's been very close. I think Fetterman is, from what I understand, Oz took the lead at one point because of a lot of McConnell money that had came in from the Senate Leadership Fund, which is the name of McConnell's super PAC. But I believe Fetterman, his fundraising and the Democratic support has pushed him in these final weeks to take the lead in terms of money poured into financial advertising, political campaign advertising across the state. And I think that there is a real case to be made that that Oz is, you know, Oz was sort of never seen in this, and that Fetterman is still largely seen as favored, not by much, but by sort of enough where they think that he would win. And I think there's a case where Oz has the momentum right now, and as I discussed well earlier in the show, having the momentum is arguably more important than having the lead in the polls. So this state will be very close, and if Democrats slip it, they're very likely to maintain control of the Senate. If Republicans hold it, again, they are more likely to hold it. So I think Nevada and Pennsylvania are the two states you're going to want to be watching the most. And from what I understand, at least to give a little bit of information, I've heard that the early voting numbers for Democrats in Pennsylvania have been decent, and that they've seen good turnout, especially in Pittsburgh and in the suburban counties. But we are going to see sort of what happens on election night. And if I were to make a prediction on it, I think in a Republican year with an open seat and a Republican that has the momentum, I'm kind of leaning towards Oz winning this, as unlikely as it seemed just, you know, 2-3 weeks ago. I also think I'm a universal pessimist in terms of Democrats actually winning elections, because I've been burned one too many times. in 2014, 2016, even 2018 was underwhelming, and especially 2020 with a lot of the Senate races and House races. So it's Pennsylvania. It notoriously underpolls Democrats. I don't hate Oz's, and Oz just did decent in the debate compared to Fetterman, and I think that that's something that really bodes well for him. And moving on to the final of the big four states for the Senate, that's going to be Georgia's Senate race. And that is between Raphael Warnock, who won the seat in the runoffs in 2020, at the beginning of 2021, a day before the January 6th insurrection, and Herschel Walker, who was a former NFL football player. So let's start with, going into Warnock. Warnock is a pastor of one of the largest, or a very significant, I don't know the specifics, but a very significant church in Georgia. He has been very prominent in sort of emphasizing his ties to Georgia, and especially with his campaigning, has been to attack Herschel Walker on the campaign ads on air, on TV, radio, social media campaigns, but on the stump to stay very positive and focusing on the things that he's done, not really giving credence to Herschel Walker and sort of the campaign that he has created. This was seen as sort of the most contentious election of the four, and I think it's recently been Nevada, Herschel Walker has made some major tactical errors. I'm sure many have heard about the numerous women that he has cheated on his family with, and then paid for their abortions, all the while saying that he does not believe in exceptions for rape, incest, or birth or life of the mother. And in addition, he, on the debate stage, sort of made a fool of himself, not really sort of speaking. He spoke coherently, but it didn't really add up to any real policies. He at one point whipped out a badge that was a fake police badge. He is someone that was seen as very competitive maybe a few weeks ago, and now is trending because of the blunders that he has made, is trending towards Warnock. The important part with this election is that there are one, if not two, other candidates on the ballot that are third party. One of them is a libertarian, and the Georgia's election rules are that if one candidate does not get above 50%, the top two have to go to a runoff the following month, which is, of course, what happened that handed Democrats the Senate in January of 2021. In terms of fundraising, this has been hotly contested, extremely close. It's not as though one party has a lead necessarily or the other, but Warnock has recently pulled ahead in terms of polling. He's about 2 points ahead, but realistically, we don't know. Even if he's ahead 49.9% at the end of the night, it doesn't matter because there's still going to be a runoff, and that runoff could change the entire calculus of the U.S. Senate. If Democrats lose one of the seats and they need to hold, if Democrats hold the seats that they need to, and it comes down to this election, they're going to be waiting another month to see if they have the majority. So those are kind of the major Senate races. It seems as though if I sort of were to give my perspective on all four of them, I'm not too optimistic about Fetterman. I am more optimistic, I think, than I would expect with Cortez Masto in Nevada. I'm optimistic for Mark Kelly, and I am optimistic for Raphael Warnock. That being said, I think that it's very, very easy that all four of them lose, or that only one of them wins. It's a no-brainer as a possibility. And I think that there's also some other outside Senate races that people have considered to be competitive, that notably, Republicans feel they can make inroads in Colorado and New Hampshire. They're delusional for thinking so. New Hampshire, Maggie Hassan is the former governor. She's a sitting senator. She is running against Don Boldick, who is just a hardcore MAGA person, very much not what New Hampshire wants to see. And they won't elect him. Hassan will win. In Colorado, there's a weird circumstance in which the Republican candidate is actually very much moderate relative to the Republican Party today, in that his name is John O'Day, and he is he's said he doesn't support Trump for running in 2024. He believes that Joe Biden is duly elected the president. He's invited Biden to the state. He has. Said that abortion should be some exceptions for abortion and at a certain number of weeks that it's unacceptable, but there was a lot more leniency, that he is sort of posing himself in a moderate light. Unfortunately for him, Colorado is voting, 6 points to the left of the nation. Biden won the state by 10. They're not going to elect a Republican. Maybe he'll outperform, what the fundamentals would say. But there's no inroads for him in that state. And on the flip side, there's Democrats running really relatively competitive campaigns in Wisconsin, Ohio, and North Carolina. The closest of those three realistically is Wisconsin, in which Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes is running against incumbent Senator Ron Johnson. Johnson was there. He kicked out Russ Feingold in 2010. And it was a very close election. It was a very close, the polling of this election showed that it was very close up until about a month ago. There was not a whole lot of advertising that the Johnson campaign was doing. They were really off the airwaves. And so Mandela Barnes was able to promote his favorables, drive down Ron Johnson's, whereas when Johnson got on the air, that kind of all evaporated, and Barnes has taken a back seat in this election. He is very much not favored to win, and although Ron Johnson is a conspiracy theorist, an insurrectionist essentially in all meanings of the term, the partisanship of the state Wisconsin leans very right. The perceived progressiveness of Mandela Barnes makes it seem as though this is not something that he can sort of overcome, especially in a state that Biden only won by 0.6. So there's that. There's the Ohio race, which is on everyone's mind, and I've seen a world of polling on the Ohio Senate race that people believe that it is competitive. Again, I would say that they are delusional. I think that to sort of give a preface of the two of the candidates running, it is J.D. Vance, who is a Trump-endorsed candidate that was as recently as 2016 a Democrat, though so was Trump before then, and Tim Ryan, who's a sitting congressman from the Youngstown, Ohio area, a white working-class voter area that was sort of a Democratic bastion for a long time and has been extremely whittled down in terms of Democratic support. But that's sort of been the story of Ohio. Ohio last voted for a Democrat in 2018, which was a Democratic wave, and they voted for Sherrod Brown, the incumbent senator, by about 8%. But before then, the last time that Democrats had a partisan win on the statewide ballot was Obama winning the state in 2012 by about 2%. And in the most recent election, Biden lost the state by 8% in a Democratic plus 4.5% national popular vote year, meaning that the state lies 12.5% to the right of the nation. There is a good argument to be made that Ryan is running a very solid campaign. He's sort of hitting J.D. Vance at all the places where sort of he needs to be taken down. J.D. Vance is not someone that has connections with Ohio. He's not seen as someone that is connected to the state, whereas Ryan very much is. And that the advertising has been flooding the waves, especially on the Democratic side, and that Republicans had to sort of bail out Vance because Vance wasn't able to raise any money. Sure, those are all things to put in the calculus. But there's no way that the fundamentals of Republican plus 12.5 and as Democrats continue to lose ground in the state can be overcome. Ryan himself was elected in 2016. He was elected before then, but a highlighted example is of his losing crossover support, the loss of Democrats overall in Ohio, is that in 2016 he was elected with about a 30% margin he was elected by. He had a lot of Republican crossover support for people that voted for Trump that very same year. In 2020, he had only won that same district by 8%. And case in point, Republicans in 2010, they had to draw a district that catered to Tim Ryan voters in a way that packed them all together. Now they're able to gut that area because that area doesn't vote Democrat anymore. Even Ryan himself in his own congressional district that he's represented for years, he has lost a significant amount of ground with voters, and there's no conceivable way in which Ryan pulls out a victory. As bad of a candidate as J.D. Vance is, and as non-catering as he is, and as not understanding as he is to Ohio ideals and values, it doesn't matter because, again, voters would rather have someone that is a Republican that, at least in Ohio, they'd rather have a Republican that they just think is, going to vote with Republicans and vote for Trump and vote with Trump type of thing, vote against Biden compared to a Democrat, especially in a Democratic, and especially in a Republican wave year or a Republican leaning year. And then the final Senate race that Democrats think they maybe have a shot at, which they don't, is North Carolina. In North Carolina, this is a very weird sort of under wraps election, strangely enough. The two candidates are Representative Ted Budd. He represents, don't know exactly what region in North Carolina, but he is in the House of Representatives. And State Supreme Court, former Chief State Supreme Court Justice, I guess you would say Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court, Cherry Beasley. Cherry Beasley lost by about, out of 7 million votes, she lost by about 600. She's a Democrat. In 2020, it was a sort of devastating loss for the Democrats, who now only hold a 4-3 majority on the state Supreme Court and are likely to lose their majority next in these coming midterms, meaning that Republicans will gerrymander the map. But that's sort of not here nor there, given the Senate race. Cherry Beasley is a very very strong contender. She's African-American. She is doing a great deal to sort of strengthen her ties in the urban areas and sort of juice turnout there compared to the rural areas, which I think is a good calculus because the rural areas tend to be very ruby red in North Carolina. And Ted Budd is someone that's kind of flying under the radar. He's right-leaning, obviously, Republican representative that has shown his fealty to Trump. And that it is sort of an election that doesn't really have a whole lot of publicity around it, and the other thing with this with regard to polling is that Cherry Beasley hasn't been able to break 45% in the polls, and is unlikely to win. The last time that a Democrat was elected in North Carolina statewide was Roy Cooper in 2020. And there are a few statewide officials that Democrats do elect, but realistically, they haven't elected a Democratic senator since Kay Hagan in 2008. And I don't see that changing in this. I don't see that changing in this election cycle. I thought I'd have time to go through governorships and House races, but unfortunately, once I get started talking about politics, it really doesn't stop. So I suppose some final thoughts that I would leave you with before I do my required PSA is that the race for the Senate is extremely contested. But the reason why I feel Democrats are not favored to win is because of traditional oversampling Democrats, polls that have showed Democrats much better than they actually are, as it's happened in many cases prior, and even in the 2014 midterms, and 2018 midterms, I would argue, especially in the Senate. Democrats are, in Wisconsin, North Carolina, and Ohio, going to lose by very similar margins, where they might come close, but they're not going to win those seats. In Nevada, there's a very formidable Republican candidate. In Pennsylvania, Fetterman is sort of on the way down, and Oz is sort of gaining momentum, and it's never what you want to see happen. And it is very possible that there could be a harsh overcorrection of polls compared to 2020, where we know that 2020 polling showed that Biden was going to win in a blowout, Democrats were going to win the Senate, they were going to expand seats in the House, and none of that happened. It's possible that a lot of the models have shifted so that 2020 polling is, or 2022 polling is more representative of a lot more of the shy Trump voter type of thing, the shy Republican voter. I don't know. We're very much in uncharted territory, as we seem to say in every single election. Are Democrats, I think, favored in Arizona? Yes. I think I'd give them a slight edge in Nevada? Yes. And Georgia the same. And it would be great for them if they did keep the Senate, but I don't know. I can't help but shake the feeling that midterms are against the incumbent party, and the incumbent party is Democrats. And even as the Supreme Court has made the Dobbs decision, and abortion is is attacked nationwide, it doesn't excuse, I suppose, for voters the rising bread prices or egg prices or gas prices when they go to the grocery store or the gas station. So I'll leave you with a little PSA before I go, as I must. So let's say, why not cover your computer camera? If you have a computer with a webcam and you don't use it, why not cover the camera up with a piece of opaque tape? In addition to government programs, there's plenty of other malware and viruses that can hijack the computer's camera to spy on you, so if you don't use it, consider covering it up. A message in the public interest from WMFO and Medford Tufts Educational Radio. This is Mitch Saunders with the closing of the first ever installment of Swing Politics. This is 91.5 WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio.